From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, you're listening to the Best of the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. The mission of the Christian Research Institute is to equip believers to answer life's essential questions soundly and persuasively, and to give the reason for the hope that you have with gentleness and respect. For more information, go online to equip.org. The following program was pre-recorded. And now, here's Bible Answer Man host, Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. Listening to Christian radio sometimes, or Christian quote-unquote television, or reading Christian literature, I am appalled at the shallowness of Christian leaders today who see Revelation as though it is a book of riddles that originate from their shallow post-Christian minds, when in reality it is a book of symbols that are deeply rooted in Old Testament history. I heard just the other day a broadcaster talking about the two witnesses in Revelation. Of course, if you want to rightly identify the two witnesses, he was wrongly identifying them. It is crucial to have the background music of the Old Testament coursing through your mind. What's clear when you do is that the two witnesses are a metaphorical reference to Moses and Elijah. Of course, Old Testament jurisprudence mandated at least two witnesses to convict of a crime. And in this case, the two witnesses accuse Israel of apostasy. In Revelation, the imagery is invested in witnesses who preside over the judgment and destruction of Jerusalem and, of course, the temple. Like Moses, they have the power to turn water into blood. Like Elijah, they have power to call down fire from heaven to consume their enemies and to shut up the sky so that it won't rain for 3.5 years. Of course, like Jesus, they're sacrificial lambs and their corpses unceremoniously litter the streets of Jerusalem, the very city in which their Lord was crucified. The city is figuratively called Sodom. Why? Because it epitomizes human wickedness. In Egypt, because it's emblematic of the slavery from which only Jesus Christ can emancipate. They're dressed in sackcloth, they're in ashes, because they're identified with the tradition of Hebrew prophets from Elijah to John the Baptist, who wore sackcloth in mourning over Israel's apostasy, called to be a light to the nations. She was prostituting herself with the nations. So the two witnesses form a composite image of the law and the prophets, culminating in the life, death, the resurrection, and ascension of a prophet, a priest who is the earnest of all who are his witnesses and who will reign with him in a new Jerusalem where indwells righteousness. In light of biblical imagery, the two witnesses are revealed not as two literal people, not a future reincarnation of Moses and Elijah, but as literary characters in John's apocalyptic narrative, representing the entire line of Hebrew prophets in testifying against Israel and warning of the soon coming judgment of God on Jerusalem. If you want to understand that more fully, more clearly, I've written a book called The Apocalypse Code. Find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. A lot of you hanging on, we'll go right to the phone calls. First up, Dana, listening in Kearney, Nebraska. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I just got a crazy question for you.
Okay.
I know it says, do not worry about the hour or the day, but I read Revelations. I've read a lot of Revelations, and I'm not a pastor or a theologian, but I just wonder, is the Antichrist a figurative or a literal being?
Well, I mean, if you want to know who the Antichrist is, obviously you're not going to find the Antichrist in the book of Revelation. Revelation never mentions an Antichrist, although there's an Antichrist figure, if you will, that's delineated as the beast. But John, in his epistles, talks about the Antichrist, and he writes, "Who is the liar? It is the man who denies that Jesus is the Christ. Such a man is the Antichrist. He denies the Father and the Son. No one who denies the Son has the Father. Whoever acknowledges the Son has the Father also." And then in his second epistle, John gives a very similar warning where he says, "Many deceivers who do not acknowledge Jesus Christ as coming in the flesh have gone out into the world. Any such person is a deceiver." And then he says, "and an antichrist." So the term antichrist refers not only to the apostasy of individuals, but also to institutions and ideologies, modern-day cults and world religions. They deny that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh and therefore can rightly be termed antichrist, using the word precisely as delineated by John in his epistles.
Oh, okay. So there isn't really, I thought I've read somewhere in the Bible that there's an antichrist that will reign, that the devil will reign on earth for 7 years, and is that's the antichrist, right? I mean, anything that brings you further away from Christ, obviously, is antichrist. But
well, anyone who denies that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh, whether an individual or an institution. But yes, in the book of Revelation, while antichrist is not mentioned, you certainly have the mention of a beast who wars against the Lamb and tries to take out the embryonic church. I mean, it's the only time in history where the church is now in embryonic form and can easily be eradicated if the fledgling church is not faithful and fruitful, because they're going to suffer under the beast. And if they are faithful for a short time, the admonition is they are going to be vindicated forever and ever and ever, and they are going to eventually receive their reward in a new heaven and a new earth wherein dwells righteousness. So Revelation does speak of a beast who is warring against the Lamb in the first century epic, and certainly we can see that this is, as it were, a type that points forward to other antichrists that will appear in every epoch of time. So we can safely say that in every epoch of time, there are individuals and institutions that war against Christ and deny that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh.
Okay. Wow, that helps a lot. Thank you very much.
You got it. I've written about that in a number of different places, including the Complete Bible Answer Book Collector's Edition, available through the Ministry of the Christian Research Institute. And let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Derek next in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Derek.
Hey, Hank. It's good to talk to you, my friend.
Nice to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. I just got a quick question for you. I hope I can articulate it well enough. There's this woman that I'm friends with and her husband. They go to a church here in the Kansas City area. And I was talking to the wife a few days ago, and she mentioned that her and her husband are going to switch to a different church in the area. It's a very charismatic revival church in the Kansas City area. You probably know which one I'm referring to. And she said one of the reasons she was doing this is because she loved the sermons at her church, but the worship and the singing at this church is a lot more, and she felt like she could get more out of it. And I just kind of wanted to ask you if you could address that and talk about kind of what is, like, the importance of worshiping and getting a sermon, like, is one more important than the other, or would you say that her decision was good or bad, or you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, I can speak about it in general sense. I can't speak about it in a specific sense because I don't know everything that went into the decision, but I think what you want to have in a church is prayer, praise, and the proclamation of the word in worship. And so you want to make sure that what's going on in all three of those categories in the worship aspect of a church is sound. The reason that's the case is all too often today we buy into ahistoric immediacy and instant novelty. Many of the worship choruses today tend to reflect values of popular culture, and we buy into them because we simply don't know the Word of God. I sometimes cringe when I hear modern-day lyrics written by people who are as shallow as a wading pool. and they're writing lyrics that people sing over and over again unquestioningly. So I think what's really great about music in a church is what Paul tells us to do, and that is to sing to one another with psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. In addition, of course, the great hymns of the faith have stood the test of time and often are rich in theological tradition and truth as opposed to being shallow. And then there are spiritual songs, I've heard many of them, that reveal the freshness of our faith. So I think what we have to do is have a respect for spiritual heritage on the one hand and a regard for contemporary compositions on the other. But remember, in worship, prayer, praise, and the proclamation of the word in community has to be done in such a way that the body is truly exhorted, edified, and encouraged.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, sir, and I enjoy listening to your program.
Well, thank you very much for your call. We'll be right back in just a few moments with more answers to your questions right here on the Bible Answer Man broadcast.
Every Bible Answer Man broadcast, such as the one you're listening to right now, is made possible through the financial support of friends like you. Each month, we depend entirely on God's provision through His people to bring you more of the broadcast, podcast, and other resources you rely on. If you want a sound proclamation and defense of the gospel of Jesus Christ to continue to be heard through the outreaches of the Christian Research Institute, become a member of CRI's support team today. Call 888-7000-CRI and stand with CRI daily in the battle for life and truth. That's 888-7000-CRI. Or visit our website at equip.org. We'll return shortly with more from Hank Hanegraaff. Angel said to them, "Do not be afraid. I bring you good news of great joy that will be for all the people. Today, in the town of David, a Savior has been born to you. He is Christ the Lord. This will be a sign to you. You will find a baby wrapped in cloths and lying in a manger." Luke chapter 2, verses 10 through 12. While many of you will soon enter the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org. Also available is The Heart of Christmas audiobook, dramatically read by Hank Hanegraaff. Breaking the code of the Book of Revelation has become an international obsession. The result has been rampant misreading of Scripture, bad theology, and even bad politics and foreign policy. In the Apocalypse Code, find out what the Bible really says about the end times and why it matters today. Hank Hanegraaff argues that the key to understanding the last book of the Bible is the other 65 books of the Bible, not current events or recent history. The Apocalypse Code offers sane answers to some very controversial questions, such as, what does it mean to take the book of Revelation literally? Who are the Antichrist and the Great Whore of Babylon? And what is the real meaning of 666? Order The Apocalypse Code by Hank Hanegraaff today. Available in softcover, MP3 CD, or MP3 download from equip.org. Or call 888-7000-CRI. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. And now, here's Hank Hanegraaff.
Thank you very much, Randy. We'll go right back to our phone callers. We'll talk to Josh next, Bakersfield, California, listening on the web. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Thanks for having me on the show. I apologize. I'm a little distracted. I'm watching my one-year-old daughter as I'm trying to ask my question here. But my question is about Ezekiel. Well, starting with the context of Ezekiel chapter 18, I believe it is. I've heard you on your show mention this passage in establishing that God doesn't hold children accountable for the sins of their fathers and vice versa. And I totally agree with that. That's kind of what it seems like he's getting across in that chapter. But I wonder, how do we understand passages like one that really came to mind is it's in 2 Samuel chapter 12, I believe. And Nathan is confronting King David, and he's telling him, you know, that what he did is wrong as far as murdering Uriah and committing adultery with Bathsheba. And God, through Nathan, you know, tells David that as a result, you know, the punishment, because I think it says in, I think it's like verse 14, he says that because of this sin, you know, he scorns the Lord, that God was going to take his child, that he was going to kill the child. And it says later in the next, I think the next verse or the verse after that, God strikes the child with an illness, and eventually, you know, the child dies.
And the question is, how can God do that? There are consequences to sin that follow inexorably, like night follows day. And as a result of that, we see David, who not only has an adulterous relationship with Bathsheba, but also has Uriah killed, as you noted, on the battlefront. And because of that, there are severe consequences. And unfortunately, there are casualties in the process. For example, if a father today is an alcoholic, it has a consequence to one extent or another on a child. But the children are not judged for the sins of the fathers. In fact, in eternity, God takes every converging factor into consideration, and therefore his judgments are altogether just and righteous and pure and holy.
And I totally agree with that, and I don't feel like I'm not trying to call, you know, like God's goodness into question, but it just seemed to me to be a little different situation than, like, for example, you know, like you were mentioning that there's consequences to actions. And for example, if a father was an alcoholic and he was driving under the influence and he crashed the family vehicle, you know, and his children were in the car and they died, I would see that more as a cause and effect, you know, consequences in a universe that has rules and gravity and all these things. But it seems like in this situation, like, this is specifically God saying, you know, that this isn't really like the child got ill, or this is God you know, labeling this his punishment on David is that he's going to kill his child, or that, you know, that he's going to actually do this. And that's where, to me, again, not trying to call into question the goodness of God, but it felt like it was a little harder to rationalize or to figure out in the context of, like, Ezekiel chapter 12.
But, yeah, well, I love the way you've set all this up. I mean, first of all, you've taken that which is clear, the Ezekiel passage, and you've made that the premise. Now you're dealing with something that we don't have all the details on. There are hints in the passage. There's the hint that God does not want the enemies of David to have reason to blaspheme the name of God, which is the ultimate issue here. And perhaps in some sense, the child died as a consequence in that fashion. But again, we can't, as human beings, take every converging factor into consideration. We don't know all of the circumstance, and therefore we're speculating to some degree. But the principle is inviolate, and that is, consequences follow to the third and fourth generation, but each person is judged for their sin. Now, again, there are different theological structures that look at this in different ways. So some say, well, God looks down the quarter of time and sees what that child would have done, and he's judged on that basis. There are different theological camps, But ultimately, what I'd like to do is leave that child in the hands of an infinitely just and infinitely merciful God and recognize that the worst thing that can happen for a child is not to die young. The worst thing that can happen is to live a long, robust life and never use it in service of the master or turn as Absalom did against his father. So there are a lot of things that we don't understand. And that's why I think the principle is, and this, by the way, is the analogy of faith that the Reformers talked about, which is that you always interpret the implicit in light of the explicit and the cloudy in light of the clear.
Awesome. Yeah, I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Hey, you got it. And God bless you and your one-year-old. Let's go back to the phone lines. We'll talk to Andy in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hi, Andy.
How's it going, Hank?
Good. How are you?
Good. I appreciate your ministry. I've been recently kind of in a debate with some Christian friends of mine, and they kind of take the position that because our country is, in their view, isn't a Christian country, that we shouldn't, as Christians, force laws that reflect our Christian values on other people because not everybody believes the same thing. I guess my position then would be Jesus said clearly, you're either for me or you're against me. So how can you say that you're for Jesus and then, whether it's at the voting booth or anywhere in any other avenue of life, you know, not represent him? So I guess I'm just curious on what your views would be, kind of how Christians are to interact with government.
Well, there are people who say you can't legislate morality, but that's simply not true. It's not a matter of whether you're going to legislate morality. It's a matter of whose morality is going to be legislated. And so I think we need to be involved in every aspect of the political process. In fact, in every aspect of life, whether it's jurisprudence or art or science, we shouldn't abdicate those positions. We should be the change agents in the culture rather than being transformed by the culture. But ultimately, the way that culture has changed is when you change the heart, then the behavior of a person changes. So yeah, we should be involved and we can't abdicate our responsibility. You know, if you have, I saw an actor on television being interviewed this morning while I was having my teeth worked on, and I was very interested, I won't mention his name, in saying that he didn't believe in any morality whatsoever. In fact, with respect to his kids, he wanted them to be able to do whatever they wanted to do, run wild. In fact, that was his phrase. And well, if you have that kind of a society where there are no rules, wow. You have chaos. You have the crumbling of society. And so there have to be rules. And those rules are either set by the size and scope of the latest lobby group or they're set by an enduring North Star. And if you can demonstrate that the enduring North Star is, in fact, God and His Word, then obviously you want to capitulate to that because God knows what is best for those that He created.
All right. I appreciate that. One other thing. What specific passages do you look at in terms of how Christians are to interact with government?
Well, Romans chapter 13, I think, is a seminal package of insights in this regard. But obviously, the Bible as a whole gives us principles to follow, and those principles are that we as God's agents are not supposed to abdicate responsibility. In fact, we are to tend the garden, which means that we not only fulfill the Great Commission, but we fulfill the cultural mandate. We're, in fact, in training for eternity. The problem with a lot of Christian notions is that we're leaving anywhere, we're going to a place up there, so let everything go to hell in a handbasket. But that's not true. We're tending a garden and it matters. We're not only in training, but God doesn't scrap things, He redeems them. He's going to redeem this planet, and so we should be involved in every aspect of society. We should know about whether global warming is right, wrong, indifferent. We should have an opinion on that. Because if we miss that, then we're going to miss a lot of other things. If, in fact, global warming is throwing tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy at a fundamental problem that you can't really solve, and then you can solve providing fresh water to everyone who doesn't have it right now for $200 billion, then you get your eye on the wrong ball. So we should be informed in all issues. We shouldn't be speaking out of our hats, so to speak. We should be speaking out of informed knowledge, and therefore the world will sit up and take notice. For example, I remember how Christian leaders were on Y2K. They followed the cultural trend. The cultural trend, I was on Hannity and Combs, as it was called back then, and both Hannity and Combs were arguing with me on the side of a person suggesting that Y2K was going to be a global catastrophe. Well, the problem was that most Christians were saying exactly what the culture was saying, when what the culture was saying was just rubbish. And so when I wrote that Y2K wouldn't even be a top 10 news story in the year 2000, everybody in the culture and everybody in Christianity came down my throat. Well, that doesn't matter. We don't need to be politically correct, but we should think things through so that we don't fall for sophistry and sloppy journalism and script torture, and in the process vilify the name of Christ as opposed to exalting the name of Christ. So we sometimes have to go cross purposes to the culture.
Okay, thanks a lot. I appreciate that, Hank.
You got it. And with that, we're out of time for this edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Do remember to pray for this ministry. Support it financially if you can. We need you as part of the team. Thanks for joining in. We'll see you next time with more.
Thanks for tuning in to the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Our website, equip.org, has an abundance of resources to sharpen your discernment skills and help you grow in life and truth. We provide books, videos, and informative articles. You can also listen to the broadcast, download archived programs, get answers to pressing Bible questions, or connect with us via social media. All this and more at equip.org. Again, the address is equip.org. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is supported by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter.
To fully grasp the significance of Christ's messianic role, you must drink deeply from the wellspring of Old Testament prophecy. In Hebrews, as in the rest of the New Testament, the Old Testament history of Israel is interpreted as a succession of types that find ultimate fulfillment in the birth, death, resurrection, an ascension of the Christ we celebrate at Christmas.
Hank Hanegraaff has penned The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season to ensure that just as you prepare your home for Christmas, you likewise prepare your heart. Order The Heart of Christmas, a devotional for the season by calling 888-7000-274 or by going online to www.equip.org.